Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Hello and welcome to Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and today on the show, huge guest, a friend of mine, someone that I really respect and admire, not just for their work in music, but just as an all-around person, David Sandstrom from the band Refused, a super underrated vocalist for Final Exit. You may also know him from the band AC4, you may know him from Text, you may know him from the Faint Sounds of Shoveled Earth, you may know him from David Sandstrom Overdrive. You may know him from Fire Orchestra. You may know him from a lot of things. His solo records. He is prolific and incredible, and it's all reflected in this conversation you're going to hear in one quick second. Refused is going on their big final tour right now. I got to see it when it was in Toronto. Got to get up and do a song with them when they were here in Toronto, and they're phenomenal. They're amazing. But they are breaking up for a reason, as David explains when you hear this episode in a second. And if you are lucky enough to live in certain places in Europe where they're going to be coming real soon, or they're also going to be going to South America and playing some shows, go and see them while you can, because as I say, they're one of the greats and they're still firing on all cylinders. So go check them out if you are so lucky. Also, keep your ears peeled for stuff David's kind of hinting at in this episode that's coming down the pipeline from that group. And I don't want to say that group because the group's ending, but that collective of people, as I should maybe put it. Anyway, you'll hear him explain it far better than I am doing right now in the episode. You can pick up A Shape of Punk to Come if you've never heard it, because we talk a lot about it in this episode. There's like a deluxe edition with a bunch of bands covering songs off it, including myself. This is a record that influenced so many people. Even people I know that hated this record, as I tell David, were influenced by it. And it kind of drove them to do what they do even more. So, yeah, this is one of the most influential records to kind of ever come out of punk, in my opinion. And I'm sure that will be refuted by some people, too. But even then, they're being influenced by it. That's how this thing works, right? All right, I'm not going to ramble on anymore. If you want to get in touch with this podcast, hit us up at turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. There's Turned Out a Punk on all those social media platforms, and there's videos on YouTube and TikTok and whatnot from Turned Out a Punk, at Turned Out a Punk on all those places. The show producer and guest booker, normally I book this one myself, hence why it took a little longer, is Tristan Abraham, my brother. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy David Sandstrom on Turned Out a Punk. David, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I was just telling you off air, I have books that I'm going to be referencing today, including one of the most generous gifts that anyone has ever given me, which is when I came and saw Refused play, an incredible show here in Toronto.
Thank you.
I showed up and you handed over a book that I have pored over since you've given it to me. And I apologize for my pronunciation. Rock E. Umia? Oh, there we go. Matching up. There we are.
It's always around. It's always just,
I've been fascinated by this book since you gave it to me, because as I said, like, Swedish punk
is to me second to none. And like Swedish music in general, we're going to get into all of it because I feel it all kind of weirdly connects, but there's just something about the music of that country. But once again, my ignorance being from Canada, even though I've toured there, is geographically how spread out it is. So
right.
Umiya, through, I guess what I've kind of, or my friends used to label Umiya core, like the stuff from like the 90s that you guys kind of were a key part of. Like that's always been the sound that defined the city to me. So being able to kind of go through this book and get the real history of not just punk, but rock and roll, in it's amazing how rich it is. And a lot of records added to the want list now. So we're going to talk about this book, but then also we're going to be talking from references from this, the Encyclopedia of Swedish Punk.
Oh, right.
Which leads me to my very first question. Are you, by any chance, this is like the rare time that I don't start with the key question of the show, are you related to Leif Taberg Sandstrom from 57 Kez?
No.
Okay. Okay.
Where are they from?
I'm trying to remember. I was trying to find it on a map, and it was like not a town I recognized.
In the north, specifically the county where I'm from, it's a very common surname. So I had a girlfriend that had the same surname, and her best friend also had it. And none of us were related. For a while, people thought that we were brother and sister. And then, you know, like we made out drunkenly at a party and people were horrified. And it's like, no, we're not. And also, you know, Dennis, singer of my band, Refused, he has another band and the drummer also bald like me. And we kind of look alike. And his name is Sandstrom, too. And no relation.
Okay. Well, I thought I was going to beat you to the punch about how you got into punk.
But it's a relevant question because inbreeding was rampant in the north up until fairly recently.
Oh my gosh. Well, we've unpacked a lot with my nonsense question, but I guess we'll get into that too. But before we get there, how did you get into punk, David? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
I have to just tell you that I digress and it's a problem. And if you're capable of policing me a bit, I think it would behoove us. I mean, it would be great for the list because I don't like doing interviews, honestly, and it's mostly because of this that I confuse myself. I enjoy being in my own mind a lot, but when I get asked questions, I get lost very quickly. And do you know the movie, The Saragossa Manuscript?
No.
It's based on, it's a Czech writer, Wojciech Haas, the manuscript found in Saragossa. It's like a classic from the 60s, like a European black and white movie classic. But the conceit of the film is that, and the book is that someone starts telling a story, and then within the story, someone else starts telling a story. And maybe they finish the story and you're back in the first story, but then someone else starts telling a story. And in that story, someone else. So at a certain point, you're seven layers in. So in the like DVD deluxe edition that I got once upon a time, they have like a graph so you can follow like, oh, now we're seven stories in and they're like back. It's in, and that's how my mind works. So when you ask that question, a lot of stuff pops into my mind. I have my obvious punk story and I'll tell you that, but punk is also a concept that I, that means a bunch of different things to me. And I'm born in 75. So punk was around by the time I really started caring about music. So I'm guessing I probably saw a clip of the Pistols or the Ramones or something on TV. And it probably didn't like stir me that much, but I was a very musical kid. So I was interested in all types of music. But when I was first truly exposed to it was in 1989, December of 1989, I was 14, I suppose. So I'd had a band for about a year. And we were playing metal, some sort of metal. And we were going to this show at a youth center in Umeå. And some older dudes, musicians, had shown an interest in me because I was a good drummer and stuff. So they wanted to sort of influence the direction of my musical, you know, path. So we got started getting into the German stuff like Sodom and Creator and Destruction and that type of thing. And they didn't like that because they were more like traditional rock dudes. So they wanted me and my friend to go see this band that were our age, but they played sort of like Thin Lizzy covers, and they did like harmonies and the vocals, and they were very, you know, confident, competent musicians. And so they were like, go see this show at this youth center. So my mom drove us to this youth center, and me and my friend went there. And we see this band, and they're good and they're fine. But then when they finish playing, this band Step Forward walks up on stage. And Step Forward is Dennis from Refused, his band before Refused. And they were a remarkable band, a truly remarkable band. And they start playing, and they're playing this really fast US hardcore, derivative of Youth of Today and 7 Seconds and FUs and stuff. And they actually played Nervous Breakdown by Black Flag at the show, but I didn't know. I just thought it was one of their songs. And they probably played like a Misfits cover, but I had no idea what it was because I was a metal guy. And they played so fast, and they were so good. And also, at some point, Dennis tore his shirt off and just said fucking shit in magic marker across his chest. And we were just like, this is great. And then the drummer, Jens, just smashed the drum set. And they just walked off. And it was one of those moments where I guess I loved metal. I was playing, getting deeper and deeper into more extreme metal. But there was something about that music that was so direct, so incredibly, it just went straight through you. It wasn't that you were standing there sort of like trying to figure out the riffs and the arrangement. And what I love about metal, it's that it's both visceral, but it also engages your like musical mind. But that show was like nothing else I'd ever experienced. And it stayed with me for a long time. And it wasn't just the band, it was also that the people who were there was like maybe 9 people who were into them who were there, and they were like fighting in front of the stage, and they looked really, really terrifying. And I, of course, later became friends with all these people and found out that they were kind of criminals and kind of scary, violent people, which I was not at all, which was very exciting too, that they were like troubled kids, you know. But that was it. And it basically, those older dudes in the rock scene that had hoped that I would take a more mainstream approach, they got fucked. That did not happen.
It's a 89 is also like a real interesting moment for extreme metal too in Sweden, right?
Very much so. Yeah.
How much connection did that stuff have to punk in its kind of origins?
Well, I think, I mean, Nicke and the guys in Entombed were, you know, like all people of that. I don't know if you read that, The Improbable History of Death Metal and Grindcore book.
It's like 10 years ago, right? Came out maybe?
Maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
They trace the evolution of grindcore, like who was playing. I mean, you're wearing a shirt, the Deep Wound.
Yeah.
Late hardcore Jay Maskus on drums. He's part of that evolution because up until, I suppose, Mick Harris broke the sort of speed wall of sound with Napalm Death, they were like maybe the fastest.
Them are the Neos, right? The Neos.
Yeah, they're in that book as one of those bands that went a little further. So I think all of those metal people, like if you listen to like the early Master stuff and all of that, and of course Venom and stuff, it's very obvious that Discharge and that stuff influence them. And I think the Entombed guys definitely liked Discharge and I suppose Anti-Cimex and stuff. But it was important at that point to disassociate from the sort of kind of goody two shoes aspect of like American hardcore. And there were people in like the south of Sweden who were already like kind of straight edge, and that stuff did not sit well with like the metal people who liked their beer, and it was like it seemed a bit like you were class president or something if you were playing hardcore and you wanted to be like a misfit, an outcast. So I think it was very important for the scenes to be not connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Like hardcore, it seems to drift away from punk every once in a while. And the further it drifts away from punk, to me, the less interesting it kind of gets.
I agree. I mean, it's an interesting thing where I like a lot of progressive and very experimental music and stuff like that. But I it's funny because I'm in Refused and I made this record Shape of Punk to Come with my friends in this band, which is considered sort of a progressive or, you know, record by some. But I'm not interested in progression in hardcore. Like if I want to listen to hardcore, I go, or punk, I go back to either contemporary bands that sound like Conflict or Anti-Cimex or something like that, or Blitz, and I'm really not interested in moving that genre forward. I much prefer listening to very experimental music and then listening to visceral, extremely primitive, violent punk.
Yeah, like for me, it's the rawness and the closest you get to the just pure expression.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why metal for me has always been harder to get into, because there's definitely metal bands I do find this with, but of times with metal, there's an edifice that kind of gets put up.
Yeah.
And
well, look, as a metal guy, it was a strange, I mean, metal is predominantly working class genre, much more so than punk and hardcore, much more so than I would say hardcore at least, which is, I also think is an interesting aspect of this genre, is that even the most primitive bands have lyrics that are a bit more, there's been a bit more labor with the messaging or whatever. Whereas with metal, it's almost like you get the feeling a lot that the rest of the members don't really care what the lyrics are in metal. It's just, and almost, and I mean, like, honestly, I don't really, I mean, there's metal bands that I love that I just never checked out the lyrics. I don't care what they sing about. But those years in like, from, I guess, 87 to like 91 or something were very hectic years in metal, because the thrash thing came and sort of went, and then the death metal thing came and went, and then black metal came, you know, like it was a year of a lot of bands being very promising and maybe getting bigger deals, and then sort of their careers panning out and the genre sort of getting watered down. And I experienced the first sort of like that musical movement that I experienced was like that death metal thing, the early Earache stuff. I was primed, perfect age for that stuff, like all those records that came out, like Godflesh and Carcass and Morbid Angel and Entombed and Bolt Thrower, and like all that stuff was just like, that was all me and my friends listened to. And then it was very sudden that I at least felt that it just kind of lost its way. It just became very uninteresting very quickly, partly the sort of Morrisound sound. I don't know if you know, like the Florida, yeah, like bands started going down and started, it just became formulaic, or a big part of it became formulaic very fast. And my transition into hardcore was a result of that I felt kind of disillusioned with metal, which had been so exciting, so experimental and so wild. If you think about all those bands I just mentioned, they don't sound alike at all. and with like Sepultura and all those bands in there, was a lot of interesting stuff going on. And then all of a sudden, it just felt like I couldn't follow a lot of those bands or on their third or some of them, even their second albums. And to me, hardcore punk, I mean, I'm a lyrics guy. I mean, I'm a reader and I'm a writer and stuff. And it, that stuff really, really matters to me. And what I was hearing in hardcore was so much more exciting to me. And I was actually being challenged intellectually and politically and, you know, by the lyrics that I was reading with bands. And that was definitely not happening with metal. So I basically just like, I met Dennis. We started a band and I just like switched more or less. I just left metal behind for a while.
It's interesting. Like going back to what you're saying about these bands on their second and third records, I think you run into that same problem with punk and hardcore too, where you're trying to be as extreme as you are, as you can be in your message, in who you are, your expression, obviously in death metal, speed is important and all this sort of stuff. But then where do you take it? And that's what I think.
Right.
I think Shape of Punk to Come was such a interesting shift because it all of a sudden said like, oh, you can just do whatever you want. Before it felt like you had to leave punk to do that. Like you had to become like, I'm a crossover metal dude now, or this is my country project, or this is, but there was like a way of just bringing all that into what you were and putting, you know, and that's why that record to me is such an important record, because I know people that hated that record so much, but that inspired them to do what they were doing even more.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's like that
it's
record.
It's a very annoying title to have on a record.
It's that it's the title. It's the confidence, you know, like punk is somewhere where confidence is something that's like, as much as people respond to it, like you look at HR on stage in his prime, there's a confidence that makes him that great, but also we're all supposed to hate that too, right? We're all supposed to be underachievers that don't like confidence. So that record, I remember that record coming out and just, it was like a monumental shift. And but it also, like, as someone who winds up kind of trying to pursue a career in this kind of music in a way, I think it gave an option for bands.
Yeah. Well, I think that what made us feel like we wanted to do it and could do it, it didn't come from hardcore punk. We didn't, I don't think we felt that we'd seen other bands do that type of thing within that genre. It was very much a result of us being in a phase of our life where we were really being like, well, what are the great, great records and what happened with those bands and where did they go at this point? And we were listening to a lot of other music, like the last MC5 record maybe, or like There's a Riot Going On by Sly and the Family Stone, you know, like just like later, like Loaded by Velvet Underground or something, like later records by great bands where they sort of like managed to reinvent or redefine themselves in some sense. Like we had incredible confidence. Of course, which is very, very annoying. And it's the kind of confidence you can only have when you're like 22 or whatever I was, 22 or 23.
You can't have it when you had kids. Once you have kids, you're humbled.
Yeah. I mean, just making a record these days is such a...
Yeah.
It's a feat. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yeah. But it was very much that specifically me and Chris, who kind of wrote it, we didn't care about what people were expecting of us. And then Dennis provided a sort of safe haven because he was the one connected to the scene, and he had been the tape trader and the letter writer, and he was the one who knew everybody, and he was concerned with our sort of position as a hardcore band because we finally had like a record out on an American label and we toured the States, and like we were sort of established in a minor way, and I think he liked that. But I have like some sort of like, I don't think I have autism or Asperger's, or but I just I'm incapable of caring about that stuff. And I think it would behoove me, it would be great for me as a musician if I did. And I think I maybe could have made a bunch of records that people knew about if I did, but I just don't. So he was very concerned with what was happening in 97 when we were writing that record. And me and Chris just got a rehearsal space, a new rehearsal space, and we didn't tell Dennis and John where it was, because we just wanted to make this record and not have anyone get, you know, like just try and stop us, I suppose. We just wanted to do it. So Dennis would just get cassettes of like these long jams of riffs that would be finally end up as like the main riff of songs on the record, but he would just get these like 5 minute jams around one or two riffs, and he would just be like panicked, like what are we turning into now, like are we a jam band or something? And we were just like, no, we're just figuring it out, and we just keep giving him cassettes as the thing progressed. And we would rehearse at least once a day, me and Chris, while making it. And it was this it was a pretty beautiful experience just doing that with Chris, because we had been friends for a very long time, and I had brought him into the band because I knew that he had something, but he had just been a fan of the band earlier. In the first couple of years of the band, he'd just been in the pit basically when we played in Umeå, but I felt like the band that we were couldn't go where I wanted us to go. So I brought Chris in, and then Chris was the one who really, really pushed us in that direction.
It's a mind fuck to be the lead singer in a hardcore band. I think at any stage but the very beginning, where it's awesome. Yeah. And then as you kind of go through these growing pains, you're the one who sees it. Like we were talking off air about the differences being the lead singer of a band, playing certain types of shows, and I think it extends to like the creative direction of the band too, because I've been the albatross around Fucked Up's neck at different times, being like, no, kids won't mosh to this, like like, are you kidding, like how are they going to sing along to this part, like that's crazy.
And
I feel like, and then especially as the band goes on and a band gets more popular, like I wasn't there. I've watched the documentary and stuff, but like when the band broke up, I think I had a lot more understanding of how that would happen, having been in a band that came out of hardcore that kind of like reached for the stars from the gutter kind of thing. It's a mind fuck, and it definitely affects everyone in the band differently. And
when you do it, like, I mean, that thing has to be figured out if you're going to evolve as a band. And these days, of course, I think we did it completely in the wrong way. Although I also think that record is good. We did it completely the wrong way because, of course, it was mine and Chris's vision. And Dennis did an amazing job. I think he's never been better than he was on that record, too. And we talked about this recently, that I was like, maybe we should treat you like shit because you perform like you did your best stuff on Shape. And we were such assholes to you. Like we didn't even allow you in the rehearsal space. Like, and you were so like stressed out, and you just wrote like your very best stuff. But I mean, at the end of the day, it was mine and Chris's vision. So then suddenly we're like, oh, we're going to be a band again now on tour. And the other guys were sort of like, yeah, this is not my band though anymore, because you guys made a record without us. And, you know, if we'd had more patience and not been that young, we could have maybe gotten there slower, but as a unit, maybe, possibly.
Yeah, but like, what would the next record have sounded like? Because I think you had taken the sound as it was.
Yeah.
To the furthest place, right? Like.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, we weren't the band to make the next record. I feel like that thing, I mean, like, because I think both me and Chris lost complete interest in just making music that would entertain someone. I spent several years making more or less unlistenable music.
I love the Text stuff. I think that Text record's amazing. Like, it definitely is a challenging record, but in a way that I think is like really cool. And
the text record started out as a, because with Shape, me and Chris were like, in order to appease Dennis and John, we told John like, well, you can make like a whole just electronic song on the record by yourself. You can, and we'll just put it on the record, which I regret now because it's not dated. It's sort of like an intermission called Bruitist Poem Number 5 or something. And it's very much like third grade sort of abstract jungle music, whatever. But we also said to Dennis, like, you can do the cover and you can do like all the liner notes and we'll wear the suits you want us to wear. Like, we'll look like the band you want to, like, we'll do it all. That's as long as we can make this. But then after Shape, as a last ditch effort to sort of save the situation, we were like, let's make a record where everyone gets to do their own, like, we'll make a double record, but everyone gets their own side. That was the original idea. So I'll do the A side and Dennis will do the B side and Chris C and John D or something. That was the idea. So that's how the Text, and it wasn't called anything. It was just like supposed to be another Refused record. So Dennis actually made some very strange recordings for that. And so my stuff on that Text record is stuff that I made for like a fourth Refused record.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But then, of course, we broke up before that was finished. So then we just, the rest of us without Dennis, just finished it at like as a new project.
Because also then the Faint Sounds of Shoveled Earth 2 was the record you did.
Oh, right? My God.
We were obsessed with, like, I remember my brother and this friend of ours, Boris, who was the guy who got Shape Punk to come because he was living in Europe first and sent it back to us.
Right.
I remember we got Rotate This in Toronto. We got them to order it in, or like there were multiple people with copies of that in Toronto. We were like very excited about that record. But
that's crazy.
But it felt like a rejection of everything that kind of came before it a little bit. I haven't been able to find it again online to listen to it. So
yeah, no, I've suppressed it.
Okay.
Completely. I actually even limited the pressing because I felt like when I made it, I felt like it was more like a demo. So I don't remember how many it's a CD. It's a solo CD that I made. And I wrote it at the same time as Shape while we were writing Shape. And then we recorded Shape for a month, mid-August to mid-September. And we finished on a Friday. On the Monday, I started recording Faint Sound. So I made it at the same time. So I recorded and mixed that between recording and mixing Shape. So it was simultaneous.
Did it come out after you guys broke up?
I don't know.
I was trying to get the timeline in order. Because it felt like
I think it came out at the same time, actually. I think it was in Europe. Excellent.
Awesome. Sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Where were we? Faint Sounds of Shoveler. It's a line from the Slayer song Live Undead off of South of Heaven. Emptiness in Twilight's Rebirth, the Faint Sounds of Shoveled Earth. Of course.
That flew by not being a metalhead. So my Slayer knowledge is fairly limited. How much awareness was there when you were growing up of like punk music in general? Like a band like, I think it's Charta 77, who I think you guys did a song with too, right?
Charta 77 is how we say it. No,
terrible pronunciation on my part. Sorry.
All of that stuff was around, but it's like everybody knows, like, if you're not in the punk scene, you don't know about these things. And then when it's really coming into a punk scene or hardcore scene is basically like a library opening up. And suddenly it's just like, have you heard this band? Have you heard this band? Do you know about this fanzine or this scene or these people or whatever and this movement? And so once I truly became friends with Dennis, he already was a record collector. And his tastes were varied, but it was focused on like hardcore and punk and stuff. And the sort of that type of Swedish punk, I guess I'd call them trall punk as well, Karta, but they're sort of a hybrid of some other stuff. They feel like also influenced by Swedish, what we call Prague in Sweden is not progressive in terms of music. It's politics is what defines the term for Prague. So it's more like, I don't know, the Fugs or like that, like a political...
Like folk music almost?
Yeah. Pretty basic folk rock, political folk rock is what Swedish Prague is. And Ebba Grön were like... what's interesting about or odd about Swedish punk is that first wave of punk was not a repudiation of that older generation of like sort of underground or leftist or countercultural music. It was actually a continuation of it. So one of Ebba's biggest song was a cover of an old sort of prog folk song. The Staten Kapitalet, if you've heard that.
Yeah, like, would they have had some sort of level of sort of mainstream recognition? I'm just saying, because, like, you know, in...
What? Which band?
Ebba Grön.
Oh, yeah. They were huge.
So they would play them on the radio or something?
It's likely that the first punk song I heard was 800 degrees, 800 grader by Ebba, probably on the radio. But it was just, I mean, I would have just perceived it as just rock and roll at that point, because my parents listened to American rock and roll. So the punk thing, when I discovered it, just felt like a very natural continuation of that. But yeah, Ebba was a huge band in Sweden.
Yeah, like the Rude Kids to me are always so fascinating because it's on a major label. And it's like right at that first wave of punk getting popular, but it's so aggressive. Like I couldn't imagine them ever playing on the radio. They're swearing.
Mm. Right. It's such a small country. That's the strange thing. Like even for us, like I guess we did, because we were so politically radical at a time, like in the early 90s when that was not a thing, but a lot of Swedish media, specifically the state media, was still full of a lot of like old like 60s, 70s leftists, so they were very excited about us showing up talking about leftist politics and vegetarianism and veganism. So we maybe did one or two fanzine interviews, and then our third one was like for a big Swedish daily, because it's such a small country. So if you make any kind of a wave, there's music journalists and other people who will notice. So you can definitely get hugged to death as a sort of radical band in these small like Nordic countries. It's kind of odd.
It's interesting too, because like now that you say that, I think about those Burning Heart bands, and like there's not any politics in a lot of those bands. Obviously, Kang punk and raw punk and troll punk,
right.
Very political, but like not as much really with those skate punk bands.
Yeah, I guess the skate thing, like you don't really connect skateboarding to radical politics, at least not like academic, like radical politics.
Yeah.
So I think that aspect of like Bad Religion and stuff was lost on. And also, of course, English is your second language. So Bad Religion is just like gibberish to you when you're in your teens. If you're a skater in your teens and you're listening to like No Control, you're just like, what is he saying? Culture is the seed of proliferation. I don't know what any of these words mean.
But a lot of those Swedish bands later on, like do sing in English. Like English, it seems like a lot of bands have incredible grasp of it, far better than a lot of American Canadian bands.
Yeah, we study it in school from fourth grade, and we don't dub films.
Mm. Okay.
So
it's all
I
subtitled.
learned I yeah, I learned English from American rock and roll music and car chase movies that my dad would watch. Like Tulane Blacktop and like Smokey and the Bandit and Bullitt and Blues Brothers and
Gone in 60 Seconds, the original. And
yeah, all of the, yeah. And American Graffiti was a huge thing for me growing up because that soundtrack was so amazing.
So was your dad a reggae?
No, yeah, basically, yeah. But he was, it's the thing, like he was a city kid, so he wasn't like a, like Dennis's dad was more of like a classic raggare, because they were, yeah, they're more rural. But my dad was a sort of like engineering whiz, and he could like build like cars and build engines and stuff out of it. Like he was, when he was like in his teens, he was like the only guy in Umeå who could fix an American gearbox and stuff. So by the time he was 18, he already owned like several cars and stuff like that. And the American nostalgia for like their own 50s rock and roll that came with like the horrific aspects of the Vietnam era. It was like America became like sort of nostalgic about an earlier, simpler, more innocent, deeply racist time.
Yeah, happy days kind of time.
Yeah, so all that 50s music was, although I grew up in the 80s, we listened to a lot of like Buddy Holly and Roy Orbison and all of that stuff, as well as like, you know, Creedence and Janis Joplin and that. So I grew up on that music.
So it's almost like the, I guess, the Swedish version of Teddy Boys in England.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually, and it's a tax thing too, because at that time, I don't know if it's still like that, but the car tax, vehicle tax for cars older than like 20 years or even less than that was like it was incredibly cheap to have an American car. So the highest concentration of classic American cars, at least back then, outside of the US, was in Sweden.
Oh, wow.
So there was a big car culture, and I grew up, which was, I mean, it was the bane of my life. But if we were traveling, you know, like on vacation in Sweden, we would always have to go to some fucking car show and just walk around and look at fucking cars, which is like, and I grew up in like Studebakers and Cadillacs and like Ford Thunderbirds and stuff like that. So there's pictures of me in like a, you would like a shirt, like I'm 1.5 carrying a diaper and I have like a USA shirt on. And yeah. So my parents were not leftists at all. Like my dad once had like a, some American car with a V8 engine, and they were having these like anti-Vietnam protests at the big square in Umeå. And he was trying to drown out the speaker with the sound of his V8. Like they were, my dad was like anti-communist.
I think
then
that's
he got two pinko sons, and he became a vegetarian. And
I find that also in Nordic countries in Europe too. In my experiences, there's like a fear of, I guess, more Russia than communism, but like I guess communism might be an extension of that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely a fear of Russia.
Yeah, Russia Bombs Finland compilation being a key example of that.
Yeah.
First time we went to Russia, we toured through Finland before we went there. And every single person we met were like, have you been to Russia? We're going to Russia next. Or everyone's like, are you insane?
Right.
No, there's no, why would we go there?
Yeah. I met a lot of Russian people that are pissed that we never went because it's so close. But it was just not on our minds back in those days to go there. It didn't occur to you that there was a scene there.
There was like a little tiny narrow window when we went, when it felt like you could go there.
When was this?
2008, I guess we went. And first time we went, we snuck in. We took a train and went as tourists.
Right.
And it was freaky, but we were like smoking hash and like like running amok. I'm like, oh, this place is crazy. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And then we went back again for a Vice Adidas party, and the police raided the apartment we were staying in, took all the people that put on the show to jail, and watched us sleep for the night.
Yeah.
It was like, well, we're not going back again.
Yeah. Yeah, we were, my brother was a talented Greco-Roman wrestler growing up. And my parents couldn't be bothered to drive me to some other, you know, like sport thing. So I had to be one. I had to be a Greco-Roman wrestler. I was horrible at it. But he was, they went on like a, like some sort of training camp in Russia behind the Iron Curtain. Like this must have been like maybe 80. I mean, it's a, like 84 or 83, maybe even.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And my brother was so talented. They had like a competition at the end of this training camp, and he was like winning his like weight class. And so finally, because the Russian Wrestling Federation could not deal with like a Swede beating, like winning any of the
in Russia
classes. So, yeah. So they suddenly, they just like late in the competition, just brought in this dude that was obviously like an adult, like his hair, but he was like a short, stocky dude. He was my brother's weight, but he was like obviously like 39 years old or something. And so he just like totally trounced, just destroyed my brother, just so that Russia would win every discipline, you know.
It's like a Simpsons sketch or a Simpsons joke.
Yeah. My dad, when they were there, there were a couple of, my dad kind of elbowed his way into the wrestling club when he found out about this like trip. So he like got on the trip and went there, and then one evening he just got the other parents, like it was maybe two or three dads on this trip, and the two trainers, they just snuck out because they had handlers, you know, and they just snuck out the back way of the hotel to go to some restaurant and get drunk. And it became this huge thing because they were like not supposed to do that. But yeah,
definitely. It feels like Russia, I was only in Moscow and St. Petersburg, but it feels like it's cool until it's not cool. And when it's not cool, it is really not cool.
Yeah.
And yeah.
But I mean, Fred, it is like a mythological place in my mind, because so many of my absolute favorite authors and poets are Russian. So I've read so much literature from there. And it's almost like in my mind, it's like a whole world. But it's not probably the world that exists. It's not the reality that is Russia today. But it's, in my mind, it's still alive. It's this like incredible, like cultural paradise, I suppose.
Yeah, it's probably changed a lot since I was there. I know a lot of my friends that were there left. But
yeah,
going there, it was really drove home the fact that, oh yeah, there's cool people, like the punk kids, like kids that are in this scene. It's almost like a universal that, sure, there's a bunch of fucking assholes too in punk and hardcore,
right.
I'm gonna pretend not, but like, yeah. But there's like, you're always gonna meet a group of like cool kids that are interested in cool things and are doing cool things and trying to build a better space.
Of course
and
yeah
like that was one of the great experiences going there. Same, we toured China too, and that was seeing that in China as well, like just being like, you know, I think people look at, when I say people, I mean in North America, we look at foreign countries as a monolith sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I think like, mm-hmm, we don't look at America that way. Like we know like America's way cooler than the government reflects, and I think we can tend to forget that sometimes, certainly in North America, but other countries.
Yeah, I mean in the West that's true for almost anything. Like you have to really go looking for the great works of literature, even from just like the old Eastern Bloc, like to figure out what is a Polish like 20th century classic work of literature, or the Ukraine or wherever. Like you really have to go looking for that stuff because it's not being handed to us. It's easy to think that the good films are made in America and the great literature was written in England and France maybe, but It's definitely not true for movies. I don't think an American movie has been the movie of the year more than three or four times in the history of film.
Yeah, and music as well. I think
Yeah, yeah.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
And I feel like Sweden's the one country, like non-English first speaking language type country, that really punches above its weight in all genres, but certainly in punk,
right,
where you have like a representation but, on the global stage.
Yeah, but it's, I think it's kind of like, if you just look at my story, like I was a very musical child, obsessed with music. My earliest memory is playing the drums on my mom's like upside down cookie jars and stuff like that. And I got my first like play toy drum set when I was 5. I went through my parents' record collection when I was like 6 or 7, scratching all the vinyls, just, I'm absolutely obsessed. And I got like a dispensation because we have municipal music school in Sweden. This is part of the old social democratic system. So that basically, whatever your class, whatever your like economical situation, your kid can play an instrument. So everyone who has the tiniest fragment of musical inclination in Sweden from, I guess, the 50s onwards, get a chance to learn an instrument. So it's really an embarrassment of riches. It's crazy how many, like just how many, just in my collection here, how many great demos and records I have of artists, songwriters, and bands that no one has ever heard of, because it's such a safe, it used to be at least, such a very safe system. We have a great healthcare system, and it's very, very hard to, I mean, it's very hard to just end up on the street here. It's incredibly complicated if you're, you know, not one of the suppressed minorities or whatever, like if you're second generation here or something. But so people grow up and they can give music a chance for, I mean, for my generation, you could like spend 10 years just like trying out that, and it wouldn't hurt your chances on the like job market later, or you would still be able to have an apartment. So of course, Swedish musicians and songwriters have a much better shot at making something good than most other countries. It's super simple. So for example, my first band had 2 different rehearsal spaces, one through the youth center and one through some other like older musicians who were like, yeah, you seem cool, you can rehearse here. So it's very easy to get a rehearsal space and to borrow gear and whatever. You didn't have to have money. So of course, then you're going to have if you have that, you know, wide range of people getting a shot, you're going to have some good artists and good bands.
Was that first band Brain Squished Puppies?
No. My first band?
Yeah.
I had a metal band that we only made a demo and then some recordings that were never released. We were called Pain. And then we were called, we switched names to Serpent. And I was still in that band for the first year of Refused Existence. And we sort of traveled from thrash into death metal, yeah. So Step Forward's last show was in Luleå, and my death metal band, we traveled together up there to play in the fall of 91. And that was sort of the end for both me and Dennis, it was the end of both our other bands. And that's sort of how Refuse got started.
Because in 92, you do Brain Squish Puppies, By No Means, and Refuse all have demos come out.
Right. But this is, I don't think this is very interesting. I don't know.
This is the minutia that I care about.
Yeah. No, there was these three dudes, Pat, who was the original guitarist for Refused, and Chris, who was the guy who came in at Everlasting and made songs and shape with us. And this other guy called Matthias, who was the bass player for Abinanda. The three of them before these bands had a band called Brain Squash Puppies. And at a certain point, they brought me in to sing for them because it was Matthias, the bass player, found it hard to play and sing at the same time. So I was just their singer for a demo.
So were you doing like Final Exit style vocals then?
I was screaming and singing. I had like pretty good pitch. So I was in like a choir when I was a kid and stuff like that, just because they had to put me somewhere because I was a pretty hectic child. So I did like five different sports and I sang in a choir and I did, you know, so I was an okay singer. And I don't know, I guess they heard me sing. I had a punk band. I forget this. So around the time I was discovering Umeå Hardcore and Step Forward and Garbage Pail Kids and all these bands, I was in high school and I hated high school. And I was in conflict with the principal and several of the teachers. And we were doing, it was like the before Christmas break, you have this like, what do you call it? Like the ceremony before the break. And we had it for some reason in a church nearby the school. And then when everyone came back into the school, we just ushered people into this auditorium and said that it was an obligatory punk show. And the reason we did this was the generation before us, which was Chris and Pat, the two guys from Brain Squash 2, was also both in, they were both in Avinanda and both in Refuse, but never at the same time. But they were a class ahead of me and they'd done something at the graduation, whatever. And so I found out that they'd been able to skip a lot of classes to rehearse for the big graduation thing they were going to have, the show that their class put on. So I was like, told my friends who were all freaks that if we just say we're going to do something, we can just skip classes and say we're rehearsing for this thing. And then when it's time, we can just say, no, Tobias has a tummy ache or something. And we can just skip it. And that way we could skip, you know, like just go to record stores and hang out and not be in school and no one can give a shit for it. So that was what was happening in the fall of that year. I guess I was 13 or 14. But then the thing was, there were some teachers that were kind of cool and that liked me. And they were like, I'm really interested in seeing what you're going to do at this show you're doing. And then some, you know, when someone showed an interest, there was a part of me who was like, I think we should do something, you know? So we put together a punk band among our friends. And we did like a Ramones cover, Ebba Grön cover. We played the Garbage Pail Kids song, which was a local band.
Dennis was in that two-minute, right?
Yeah, Garbage Pail Kids, yeah. And then I just walked up and there were like these hockey jocks, yeah, that sort of ran the school that I hated. I hated their fucking guts.
We have the same problem here, my friend.
Yeah. And I wasn't a jock, but I was like, I played soccer and I was a motocross driver and I was a Greco-Roman wrestler. So I could take care of myself. So they never went for me, but they went for a lot of my friends and I had to bail them out a lot and rough up a jock or two now and then. But we wrote a couple of songs. There was a woodshop teacher who was like weird with the girls. Like he would touch them and stuff like that. So we wrote a song called like Pedo Fuck or something. And then on stage, and because we'd ushered the entire school in, he was right there in the front row. And I was like, this is a song about this guy. And I said his name, and it's called Pedo Fuck. And then we just played the song about how he was a pedo. And then I just stood berating the hockey jocks. He's like, fuck you fucking assholes, suck my dick, and like that kind of stuff. And so it was a nice thing because I got to like deal with that at the time. There was no like lingering resentment for all these assholes who sort of ruined those years of our lives, in a sense, that we actually just told them at the time, right there on stage. So it was a powerful, it meant a lot to me, because the power of music and the power of just being like an artist and just actually being like, we can just actually go up on stage and I have the guts to actually tell them. So let's just do it. So for the freaks of our school, it was a huge moment that someone spoke for us, you know. So that, and we were called the Flems. The Flems.
Did you guys record
And
after this or anything?
we did a recording, and it was on, it's not good, but it was on the Umeå Hardcore comp,
The
cassette comp, the
cassette
way it
comp. Okay.
is. Yeah,
Okay.
Umeå Hardcore, the way it is. It was like a copy of the New York Hardcore. I think they used the same picture on the cover or something, but it
That's
was on a cassette. Yeah,
awesome.
I for I thing is, I forget these things. Like, I even forget that there's a recording of that punk band. But yeah, and the thing was, we played a show with some of the like real punk bands, like Vectors and Step Forward, and at a youth center. And we did She by the Misfits, and I managed to nail the sort of, you know, like how he goes up on the chorus,
Oh yeah.
and I nailed that. So I got some like respect from the older punk guys, which meant a lot to me at that time. And that's the first time I think Dennis knew who I was, because he's 3 years older. They all were an older generation. Yeah.
So did you sing in other bands between Brain Squish, was Brain Squash Puppies and Final Exit?
Don't think so.
I guess Refuse is
No.
going pretty hard by that point.
Yeah. But I was always doing, I had this guitar player that had been in my old metal band, he's in this band Naglfar, this black metal band from Umeå, and he does this band called Bewitched. He's a pretty brilliant dude. He had a home studio, so I would go to his house now and then to record stuff I was doing that wasn't Refused stuff. And some of that stuff was pretty progressive. I was look it's weird, but I was looking for to make a hybrid of like metal and pop, I suppose. It sounds really weird, but I wanted sort of like melodies in the choruses, but still kind of Slayer-ish riffs. And I was making a lot of stuff like that, just as demos with him. But I would play the drums and then play the guitars and then do the vocals. And he kind of did it begrudgingly because he had other stuff to do. But he was like, okay, I can re this weekend we can do one of your songs, and I would just go there and make the stuff. And he recorded Brain Squash Puppies demo before I was with them, which was Chris and Pat. And Chris heard a lot, he played a lot of that stuff for Chris. And when Chris finally joined Refused, he sort of knew that I had a lot more progressive leanings than not anyone knew, but he had heard some of that weird experiments I'd been the weird experiments I'd been doing. So a lot of his excitement about making Shape came from the fact that he knew that there was other stuff that I was interested in doing. It was just that I didn't want to do that stuff with Refused. I saw Refused as sort of a hardcore band. And although I wanted to push the envelope a bit, I still thought of it as like, we're still like a hardcore band within this framework. And then the experimental stuff I wanted to keep separate. But Chris kind of pushed me to bring that kind of stuff in. So there's a song called like Deadly Rhythm on the Shape of Punk, which is one of mine that I wrote. And that's kind of comes from that kind of stuff, like really rhythmic, complex, crazy shit. And it was Chris that got like motivated me. He was like, you should really, really try and follow that through and see if we can do something with Refuse, but that kind of stuff. So Chris was he was very much the instigator for going more progressive musically.
It's interesting how we have the framework and the rules that we kind of put on ourselves within punk and hardcore. And the only way that things really change is when people break against that and do something that's counter to that. But
the thing is, because of who I am, because of how I function through the years, I've become friends with people from the hardcore scene that are the same. So we love hardcore for basically the same reasons, but we also have these other inclinations, you know, like Don DeVore from Ink and Dagger. Yeah, like we connected pretty immediately because there was so much other stuff that we were into that we wanted to do. And there's a bunch of people like that who just have this deep love for the original, you know, like hardcore stuff. And in some way, it's there in everything you do. It's just not necessarily genre-wise always there, but the energy, the directness, and the sort of unfiltered just anger, I suppose, or passion, power of that stuff. Just never, there's no other music where you can find it, really. There really isn't. If you go to like the early Discharge stuff, or you listen to Victim in Pain by Agnostic Front or something like that, like that stuff, it just never, it feels the same. You put it on now and it just shoots into your heart. It's so incredibly powerful. And so for me, I've never been good at genre. So I still, like, I wrote a pretty violent, very straightforward punk song just the other day. It just shows up, these things. We're just like, so I've been thinking about a sort of new Final Exit, like, related project called something else, of course, but like for a long time, because I've just, these songs keep showing up where it's not something that could be a Refuse song, or it couldn't be any of the other projects that I'm in. So it's always there.
Yeah, I feel like punk, Josh from my band, when he was on the podcast, was like, it's the real red pill. Like, once you get into this and see it, like, unless you suppress it really hard, you can never make it go away completely. Like, it's like a religion, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just stained on you.
Yeah. And when you really, really love a band or an artist, you can truly follow where it's gone in music. And if anyone's picked up the sort of, what do you call it, the baton. And with certain bands, I feel like it's like people can think it's retro to try and do something that kind of sounds like Icons of Filth, maybe, or something. But there's certain bands where you just feel like, no, but there's more there, you know, like, and when we did, you know, we did that band AC4, my motivation for that was that I felt like there was more to do in that paradigm. We didn't get there. But I still have that feeling that there's stuff related to certain bands like that that I still feel has not been explored.
That was our first time being label mates with AC4 and Deranged Records.
All right. Oh, right. Yeah.
And now we are again on Epitaph, because Epitaph bought J Tree Records. So.
All right. Right.
So we're connected twice over through label ties.
Yeah, that's great. What's the David Comes Alive?
David Comes to Life.
Right. That one pierced through for me. That I've listened to that. Or I haven't gone back to it in a while now, but I listened to that a lot back then.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Because, like, I feel like when Shape of Punk to Come came out, you guys were doing Final Exit. Dennis wrote that thing in Fight Fanzine about box sets. You guys were on Victory Records, but you're also doing comp songs on Crime Think Records. Like, it felt like to us, you guys were like, that's the kind of hardcore kids we were, where we were like,
right, yeah.
embracing with every aspect of this culture and like loving punk just as like a whole, not just as like, we're this. Like, because then it was like, you know, there's a Victory style hardcore kid, or there's like a Crime Think style hardcore kid, and never shall the two meet. So anytime those things crossed over, it was cool, because It felt all connected to us.
No, but that's the thing. I think me and Chris definitely felt that we'd never met. I mean, in hindsight, I see that there was a lot of people out there making interesting stuff that we would have connected with. But we felt very alienated from the contemporary hardcore scene, me and Chris specifically, Christopher Stan. I never checked out of Umeå Hardcore because that's all my friends basically. So I would still go to shows there and maybe in Stockholm, but I definitely checked out of the hardcore scene internationally almost completely at the end of the 90s. But I think we were a bit unlucky in that sense. And we toured with bands like Snapcase, where love those guys, but not like if we'd grown up in the same city, we wouldn't have played together or anything because they're from a very different kind of perspective. But I mean, that's also the beauty of a scene where so many different types of people can come together and sort of like connect over over the stuff that you actually have in common. But I feel like there was a hypothetical future for the band where we would have met people that we would have wanted to collaborate with or do stuff with. But thing for us too was that when you're from such a extremely peripheral place, the rest of the world seems just so, it's just this other place, it's just the other world. And we were from the, like, just being from Sweden is enough, but we're from the north of Sweden, so the bands that we were like closest with were bands like Breach and Fireside and this band called Randy from a town up north, and we had sort of been in bands parallel to each other before we formed those bands. So there was a band in Luleå called Skimbak that turned into Superdong, who played a sort of like Southern California hardcore.
I'm obsessed with Superdong because to me they're like
a
paradigm shifting band, because I've always wanted to trace where that skate punk thing.
Yeah, they were great.
Oh,
they were
that
great. Song. Yeah, but that a lot of that came from Step Forward again. Who, and I have to say about Step Forward is their recordings are fine, you know. But at the time, a band like that in a town like that, no one knew what it was supposed to sound like. And they were also kind of like the drummer mainly, he was kind of a nonchalant dude. He was more interested in like drinking and doing break-ins and just being a badass, you know? I think they just went in and just like, ripped through those songs and they left and they didn't give a shit. So the thing about Step Forward is, as derivative of US hardcore as it is, as a live band, they were quite something. Like the real, I mean, and this is an annoying thing about being from any scene, is that you should have been, I mean, you had to have been there. But it is true for that band. They were unreal when they were at their peak. And they went up and played the skate competition in Luleå. And some of those guys saw Step Forward at that show. And it sort of like got them going to start playing an American style of hardcore and stuff. So Pelle Gunnerfelt, who was the guitar player and principal songwriter for that band, and then later Fireside, and also produced a bunch of really great stuff. Like he did Songs to Fan, and he did The Hives and stuff like that. He basically, from what I understand, he saw Step Forward, and then he just went and took over this other band that was already sort of like a punk band. And so when that band broke up, two of them started Breach and two of them started Fireside. So the bass player and the singer started Breach, and the drummer and the bass player started Breach, and the singer and the guitar player started Fireside. And so a lot of those bands, Step Forward and my band, turned into Refused. And so we'd known those guys forever. And what happened was basically in the early 90s, there was like a boom of like alternative music all over the West and also in Sweden. So we all got sort of like picked up by either Stockholm indies or bigger labels. So we started out just booking each other's shows, and suddenly we were putting out records, Breeze was putting out records, Fireside was putting out records, and Randy too. And suddenly it was just suddenly not quite, to me at least, not quite a punk thing anymore. It was like an alternative rock thing, although whether the music we were playing was alternative rock, we were sort of in that type of framework. But Refused kept touring very, you know, squats and sleeping on floors and stuff like that. But there was like a, we ended up becoming way bigger than anyone had expected us to be within Sweden, at least. And it was just, I felt pretty alienated from this whole thing of trying to be like a serious band. Like, I only cared about the actual music, and I was really interested in what Pelle and the guys were making with Fireside. I was interested in what Thomas and the guys were doing in Breach, and we were trying to do our thing, and I just didn't care about the other aspects of it. And maybe if we'd connected with a bunch of American Canadian bands that were similar in mentality to us, we could have looked at it differently. But I feel that both me and Chris just wanted to get the fuck out of the hardcore scene in the late 90s. We just did not understand the point of it at that juncture.
Yeah, because I think it would only have gotten worse for what you guys were feeling as mm-hmm. the record got more and more popular after you guys broke
mm-hmm.
up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it would have been Sweden and America.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that would have been a good thing. I was not very mature. Like, I just cared about music up until that point. So I'd not tried to have like a life at all. I just, day and night, just music. That's all I did. And if we had become like a functioning, touring, making money type of band, I don't think that it would have been good for me personally. But I was also having a lot of mental health issues at the end of the 90s. So it was very good what happened, because we got a chance privately in our respective lives to sort of regroup. And me and Dennis talked a lot about this actually lately, that he just sort of carried on, and he had to deal with all of that stuff at a later stage. And that I'm really grateful that I just sort of went back home and just started working on other types of music and more developing friendships and, like, you know, like relationships and other stuff. And I started a collective in Stockholm and got deeper into leftist politics and a little bit of activism, and just like just reading more and just getting, you know, sort of growing as a person. Because when you're, you know this, like, when you're like, I was 16 when we started, and then we just started like DIY touring, and we did that for like 6 years. And it's sort of like it's arrested development, basically. You're sort of like stuck in this, you're in the rehearsal space, and then you're on tour, and you're up all night, and you sleep all day, and you have no connection to other peers outside of that, because there's no room for it, you know. So I felt like most of the 90s, I stood still as a human being. But I developed a lot as a songwriter and a musician, but I had a lot to catch up on once Refused broke up. A lot.
Yeah, someone told me one time that you stop maturing the year you become a full-time musician. And, mm-hmm. and you do, like you're saying, like, when you're in that world, time flies by, because every day is the same. And it's just, so for you, it doesn't feel like time's passed, but like you're saying, everyone around you is growing up. And you're what do you mean? This is not how people live outside of this little bubble that I'm a part of.
Well, it's sort of like being, what do you call it when you're ahead of your years as a young, you're precocious.
Yeah, precocious. Yeah.
Precocious. Yeah. As a child, if you're like six, but you have the mind of like a 9 or 10 year old, you get disconnected from your peers and you don't go through. So in a certain sense, you can see them ahead, but later on, it becomes obvious that you missed a lot of steps in your personal evolution because you were too smart or too whatever. And there was an element when you were 18 and touring where it seemed like you had your life together and so much was happening and everyone else was in school. And then when you were still just broke and touring at 28 and everyone else had like a big apartment and a job, you were like, they were giving me their hand-me-downs.
Yeah.
They were like, you can't, are you still wearing those pants? You're like, oh, thanks, man.
Yes, I think I'm finding that point now in my mid-40s. I think there's a lot of parallels, weirdly, between Bikini Kill and Refuse, especially when the two bands break up, how you have the lead singers of each band doing a much more commercial sort of step out afterwards, and the rest of the band sticking together and doing something different.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it's funny because Dennis is, like, in certain regards, more of a punk guy than I am, but at the same time refuses the least DIY thing I've ever done. Yeah. Everything else I've done has been very small, and that's how I want it. That's how I like it. Like the best feeling is like you made this yourself. It was delivered to your house and you're selling it. Like, and there's no one in between. And I absolutely fucking hate the music industry, all of it, completely, and I always have. And I'm 50 now, and I've sort of made a vow that for the rest of my life, however I live, it's just gonna be, I'm gonna go back to the way I thought about stuff when I was a very, very stern and serious 16-year-old. It's just like, I want to make the stuff myself, and I want to put it out myself with friends in some sort of like DIY setting. And I want it to be just, I don't like big shows either. I want the people who are there to be interested in the specific thing that's going on. And we just recently played Hellfest main stage with Refused. And it was like, someone said 30, someone said 50,000 people. It just does nothing for me, because it's, you know, that there's such a small percentage of the people at the show who know about the band or care or are interested in the type of music that you're making or what's going on stage. And it's just this event, it's just this happening, you know. And I loathe that feeling of being up there like you're a Muppet, you know, like there's someone's hand up your ass and you're sort of just like going through, you're just being like paraded as if you're this product. I hate that feeling immensely. And in a sense, that's sort of what my definition of punk is. It's not so much genre or stuff like that, but it is the context of how you do things. And I'm not pleased with what we became after the reunion. And that's one of the reasons that we're breaking up, is that I don't like how we behaved as a band, really. But it at least it was a collective thing. Like, I didn't jam something through, or me and Dennis didn't decide what was going to happen or what we were going to do. It was very much a collective phenomenon. But I would like to exist outside of those worlds of music from now on.
Well, it's so hard to like to try and be a band of any sort of substance and then be in that situation, because like the bigger your band gets, the more assholes are going to be in the crowd. Like, that's just the way it works out. And like you're saying, like, not that you want everyone to think exactly like you or to be exactly mm-hmm. like you, but I kind of want to just be at a show where we're at least all on the same page for the most part.
And right. Well, I mean, if you have a healthy, if the scene or whatever, the community is based on healthy principles, if it is about like, this is a communal thing and I'm listening to your band, you're listening to my band, we're putting this out ourselves, it's as ours, then there will be an interesting mix of people. But what happens once you get past a certain point of popularity, it becomes more monochrome, like the audience. There's a certain point where the jocks show up, basically, and you become like a part of like an idea of something, more than just what you actually are. I think there's a lot of people who can function like that and stay themselves, and I totally respect that thing of wanting to do a band and wanting to be out there. And specifically the way it was with Refused, that we had all these things we wanted to say, and part of the point of the band, specifically in Sweden in those days, was that we got pretty big and we got to get these ideas out to a much bigger audience than would have heard them. We weren't standing like in someone's basement shouting about how religion sucked. We were on like a huge festival stage in front of 20,000 people talking about how religion sucks. You know what I mean? Like, it's,
yeah.
But at the same time, I feel way less confused when it's a communal thing, and when it's like a shared experience, and you're doing most of it yourself.
Yeah, because there's a point where it gets mainstream enough that there's a group of people that are going to be coming out that aren't even going to not necessarily get what you're saying, but are going to be actively against what you're saying, but just they can interpret it. Like Rage Against the Machine is a perfect example. Like that Free Tibet concert where they did those Free Mumia shirts and people turned them inside out and wrote Fry Mumia, and then still watched the band play. Like, how the fuck do you not get it? But that's the way people work.
Well, I mean, if you have an empathy disorder,
which humanity definitely does. I feel like looking at what's happening every day and just seeing how can people not see this is fucked up.
Yeah. No, but I don't know if I like conflict. I mean, not I like the band a lot, but I also like just conflict. I like discussion. I like the meeting of ideas, you know, like I really enjoy when someone wants to criticize something that you've done, or you know, like it gets me going. Like I enjoy that. I enjoy the communication and the sort of, it's exciting to me, and I feel like I can miss that from being in a smaller scene where people would be just like, you're fucking wrong about this, or like, why are you doing this, or like this, like the directness of it. I can miss that, definitely. Where it's just like people are just like, you're great. Like I get that with Refused these days. I feel like it's a lot of just like, awesome. You're great. That's great. Awesome. And you know, just like, where's the fucking, where's
the
meat
haters
of the thing? And, you know, but sort of like, I feel like maybe it doesn't matter what we do if no one has anything to say about it.
Yeah, that's the, I guess that's the challenge, is like trying to find a way to like get your art out to as many people as can be affected by it, but realizing that it's not going to be mass conversion. It's going to be micro conversion.
But it's also on you to make the type of art that gets people excited or feel challenged or, you know, like provoked. And I think, you know, that one of the also another one of the reasons we're ending Refused is that a new band has sort of formed within the band. Like the four of us are making new music, and it's just not, I felt it couldn't possibly be interpreted as Refused anymore, especially since Chris left. So we're doing a new band, and a lot of these things that we've been talking about now, I badly want them to define what we're going to do next. And it's, the messaging is not going to be so literal and so direct, and the music is not going to be as controlled. It's going to be a lot more wild, I think, and a lot more experimental. That's the
awesome
dream.
What, how far along are you guys in that?
Hard to say. It's Matthias, who plays the guitar now. He's obsessed with the record Not Fragile by Backman Turner Overdrive.
Yeah.
And that was my dad's favorite record growing up. And when we met in 95, he had never met anyone for whom that was the most important record. So we spent, like, within minutes of meeting, we just went down to the rehearsal space and just played that record over and over together, me on drums, him on guitar. And since then, basically, we've wanted to play together and have like a band. And so Magnus and I, the bass player, we played together since we were teens. He's the one who taught me time as a drummer. I was a good drummer, but I was all over the place. And he was the one who's like, yeah, you're switching like tempos in between parts. Like, so let's try, you know, like, so we learned to be a rhythm section together. So you can't really buy that stuff the way it sounds when we play together. And Matthias is a magnificent guitar player. And Dennis is, you know, very, very, partly very good at his thing, but he also has a hunger to do something that he's not been doing. There's a lot of stuff that we love that hasn't really come out in the stuff we've been doing with Refuse. So something's going to happen. We have a bunch of riffs. And yeah.
Well, I don't know. Speaking of bands that no one draws influence from, when Dennis was on the show, he said that an early influence on Final Exit was Raid. Is that true?
I guess. Yeah. I mean, we
not morally, I mean, but just like.
Well, I mean, the main influence for Final Exit was that Refuse was so serious. I mean, we're so serious and severe, and that we're really silly people. And we also have a deep love for the older versions of hardcore. And so it was actually just one day at the rehearsal space when I think it was Chris and Pat who had discovered Dennis had played them probably some early Agnostic Front and some other like fast stuff that they liked. And they just started playing around with like playing some faster violent stuff. And then we were just like, I could scream and then, you know, Dennis could play the bass or whatever, you know, like, and Pad was the guitar player. So he would play the drums. It was sort of like a Project X, like just switching instruments type of thing. And yeah, there was a bunch of, we played Victim and Pain, our first show, very first show. But it was very much of just getting to let loose. So in a sense, Final Exit is the same band as Refused. It was the same members or the same like pool of members, like Pad. I think Pad was in Final Exit when he got fired from Refused and then joined Avinanda, and Chris went from Avinanda to Refused, but Final Exit stayed the same. Like it was, you know, it's so incestuous. So I always saw Final Exit as just like, sort of like the B side of Refused. Yeah.
It falls into like a punk tradition too of not, I don't want to say a parody record because it comes from a deep love of the music that you're making, and it's not silly, but there, like you're saying, there's also a sense of humor to it within.
Yeah. But I mean, a lot of early, I mean like DRI and that stuff, it was funny.
Oh, absolutely. Stuff. Absolutely. And like you and look it's at more Project that X tradition. Yeah, 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 Project X, and but like Skin Disease, which was Chumbawamba's fake oi band.
I don't know about that.
I'm a Wanker. It's on one of the Sounds compilations. That was Chumbawamba when they first formed as their like fake oi band.
Yeah, yeah.
And they got on this oi compilation with it.
Like you can be both things. Like we were very serious about the stuff that we were into and talking about, but we also could see how funny it was, in a sense that we were so like preaching from the stage, but we're these stupid working class kids from the far north of Sweden who barely read a single fucking book, you know, at that point. So we were kind of making fun of ourselves and also making fun of like other aspects of contemporary hardcore that we thought was silly. It was like some of those songs are so passionate about like animal liberation that it's just like insane. And Earth Crisis were great on Firestorm stuff, but it's also kind of funny, like it's almost biblical language about justice being served. It's funny, that stuff. And that's sort of what drove it. It was you can be both at the same time, like take it seriously but also make fun of it.
Yeah, and it's only a record that could come out of people involved in the genre to understand the nuances of it. Mm-hmm. And to but I do think there's like a real tradition of this thing within punk. Yeah. To have this sort of like less serious outlet band.
Yeah, yeah. No, we badly needed it. And for a while, people didn't know that it was the same member. So Final Exit would talk shit about Refused in a fanzine. And then Refused would talk back. And a lot of people thought that it was like an actual conflict or whatever, which I think is very funny meta stuff with like the same band talking shit about itself.
I think we probably were inspired because we used to write fake letters complaining about ourselves to Maximum Rock and Roll. And I think I think it came from us hearing about that, maybe.
I love that.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about this book.
Yeah, we have not talked about
this book. And all of your punk stuff.
All my weird nerdy questions about other stuff that I want to get into, believe me. Well, I was going to ask you, because like you're on a comp with them. Was there any relation with that band Uncurbed and Refuse?
No. Let's see if I can place this. I think we were friends with one of the guys in Uncurbed. We became kind of big kind of fast within Sweden. And we had like all our straight edge ideas and veganism and all that stuff. So there was a lot of like the old raw punk and crust people who just like partly just thought we were full of shit and like pretentious or whatever. But also some of them, I think, thought it was kind of funny to just hate us. So there was a lot of like, not a lot of confrontation, but there was bands writing songs, extra many songs about getting drunk because we were straight edge, or you know, like stuff like that, anti-Refuse songs. And if we play with those types of bands, we could expect getting like meatballs thrown at us and stuff like that. So there was a sort of, it wasn't antagonistic, because of course I love a lot of those bands that like we played with, like Dischange, and I thought they were great, and like a lot of those bands, because I mean, I would often wear a Discharge shirt, and I think it could probably, both guys like that maybe thought that was great, but also hated that a straight edge dude from Refused had a Discharge t-shirt. But we did play once with a bunch of crust bands in Jönköping, which is kind of a hotbed for that type of stuff. And Jonsson from Anti-Semix was there, the singer. And he was kind of freaking Dennis out backstage. So Dennis sort of like, you go talk to him. I can't talk to him. And I sat and talked to Jonsson for a while. And this is, maybe we could end on this, but it's a magnificent testament to DIY ethics, because he was out of his mind. Like at that point, I wasn't capable of like discerning what was going on, if it was just drunk or if it was on pills or whatever. But he was saying these crazy things to me about dreams he'd had, and you know, like walking so fast across the desert that the sand turned to glass, you know, like weird shit like that. And I was just like, okay, man. And I like freaks, you know, like, yeah. So I thought it was awesome. I just loved talking to him. And then I guess he kind of liked talking to me. So at a certain point, he sort of snaps out. He has like a moment of lucidity, and he sort of goes, you like US hardcore, right? And I was like, yeah. You know, I had the first Minor Threat 7-inch, but someone stole the actual like record, or I like, lost it. But I have the lyric sheet. Do you want it? And I was like, yeah, man. And this was like a Friday maybe, or a Saturday. He was out of his mind, like drunk, maybe on drugs, whatever. And so we play that show. We go home on the Sunday. And I swear to God, on the Tuesday in the mail was the Minor Threat lyric sheet.
That's awesome. Do you still have it?
No, it's a long story. I framed it. I had it on my wall for many, many, many years. But I moved. I've lived in LA for a while, and I had it in that house where I lived. And long story short, I think it got sold by a dude who relapsed.
An amazing story, though. That's so,
yeah,
like so
awesome. yeah because it was because I was just like, he's just talking now, like this is just talk. And then when like just like the very first mail day after the conversation, it was in my hands.
That's amazing.
Those old punk dudes are just, yeah, they're for real.
Well, I got way more questions for you, but you got a day to live. So, David, anytime you want to come back on here, you are always welcome.
Yeah, maybe we should do like have like some sort of like what do you call it? Like a
like bring a schedule, multi-part series.
Like about what we should talk about, because this was great. I love talking to you. So this is awesome. But it would have been great to talk about this book, among other things.
Well, maybe you, me and Dennis can do an episode like we were supposed to do in Toronto.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. That'd be great. We could talk more about like the really good Umiya hardcore shit. I've had this plan for a long time to do like a covers record of Umiya hardcore stuff, because it's so spread out. If people are like, oh, I want to get into Umiya hardcore, it's very hard to find all the good shit, because some band just put out a 7-inch or a 10-inch, and some stuff was on Desperate Fight, and I don't know if you can get a hold of that stuff. I don't think it's on streaming, or maybe it is, I don't know.
No, the tapes, especially, you can't find anywhere.
Yeah, but there's a lot of stuff that was just like some band put out one amazing song on a 7-song cassette, like, and I've been talking to Dennis, this is like 10 more than 10 years we've been talking about this. I have the title for the record and everything of us just playing like the very, very best shit from like 15 or so years of Umiya hardcore, and just putting it out as sort of like, you know, like it's like a nuggets, whatever, but it's just like played by us.
Oh, that's awesome. I'll buy that.
But yeah, but we could talk about Regulations, and we could talk about the Vectors, which is, I think, the best punk band from Umeå ever.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey, football fans. Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.